Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome back our great guest co-host, Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. How are you today, Michael?
Doing well. How about yourself?
Good. You enjoying a little bit of fall weather and change of seasons?
I've pulled out my flannel.
Ooh, and we might need some warm things soon. Speaking of warm, we've got some great guests who I think are going to enlighten and warm us up. How'd you like that connection?
I liked it.
It's a stretch, but it's a good one. About some important topics today, about allied health and why interdisciplinary care is good for patients and why we actually probably need to advocate for even increasing it. We'll be talking with Dr. Stephen Hooper, the Associate Dean and Chair of UNC North Carolina's Department of Allied Health Services, and Dr. Eileen Berker and Dr. Philip Griffin, two faculty members there who are doing some really fascinating research. First, though, we're going to talk about some research that matters that we are actually looking at. And let's talk about this very first research. It's about sleeping less and feeling better. That's the kind of research that I shouldn't probably be talking about to one of our residents who's working 80-hour work weeks.
Yeah, and I think this is something that I don't think about usually telling people about. So let's dive right in. So this came out of the Journal of Clinical Psychiatry out of the University of Pennsylvania's Sleep Center with over three decades worth of studies on the effect of sleep deprivation on depression, and it just came out in September of this year. And Adam, what did these results show?
Well, so they're differentiating here about intentional sleep deprivation rather than people who can't really fall asleep, who we know have higher symptoms of depression. We know people who have depression have more difficulty falling asleep. But this is taking patients who really do have sleep problems and depression and actually sleep depriving them. And they're saying that it could drastically reduce symptoms of depression, and up to 60% of people, these short-term reductions in depression, or particularly in people who maybe have manic depressive illness, when they did not have sleep for up to 36 hours. I find this really interesting. I'm not so certain how I buy into it, because this is a really structured setting. This isn't something that we could implement easily, I don't think, in our clinic.
Would be difficult. And these results, it didn't matter whether or not the patient was actually taking an antidepressant medication or not. And I think more research needs to come out to look at how sleep deprivation helps reduce depression, how we would apply this in different situations, and who's really going to benefit the most from this.
And what they found is some of the benefits accrued the most for when this sleep deprivation intentionally was combined with morning light therapy and certain medications like lithium, so particularly for people who maybe have a bipolar illness. So very interesting, complex research. More needs to be done. I don't think we're advocating, Michael, that you go 36 hours without sleeping and come back and take care of patients yet.
Yeah, I don't think anyone would want to see that.
Let's talk about our very next research that matters that I bet we'll both be in perfect agreement on, and it's about frequent sauna bathing to help prevent high blood pressure. What do you think?
Well, I know what your next birthday gift is going to be, a personal sauna, because this is going to be helping your blood pressure. This was actually published recently in the American Journal of Hypertension out of the University of Eastern Finland. I've not heard of that university before. And what it showed was that essentially that men who had a sauna 4 to 7 times a week had significant blood pressure reduction.
Yeah, this involved over 1,600 middle-aged men who didn't have high blood pressure, but maybe were at risk for certainly developing high blood pressure. And they followed them over a long time. And just as you said, the risk was lowered significantly the more they had saunas. If they had it 2 to 3 times a week, it was 24%. If it's 4 to 7 times a week, it was 46%. Now, I wondered, you know, I mean, I think if I just went to Finland, my blood pressure might be a little bit lower. But I really think this is great research that's important because it suggests they really study the mechanisms. And it's a non-drug alternative that increasingly could be something you would recommend to patients. It's, you know, obviously there has to be some safety concerns, but maybe a lot less dangerous than some of the medicines they get.
Absolutely, and stay hydrated if you're going to be spending more time in the sauna.
Well, we'll have to really check this one out in Finland if I think find some ways to get over there. Our next research that matters really has to do with a chronic bronchitis that can lead to chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which is really one of the number one killers of people in the United States, around the world, mainly linked to smoking.
Yeah, this was published in the New England Journal of Medicine, actually involved our own campus, UNC researchers, and they essentially have potentially identified the first ever objective marker of chronic bronchitis. And the most exciting thing, I think, Adam, is that this may actually lead to more diagnostic and prognostic tools to aid with chronic bronchitis, being that it is so common in our patient population.
Yeah, they were particularly looking at this protein called mucin, and they had analyzed over 1,000 smokers and non-smokers, and they were looking at the phlegm for that, the smokers and the non-smokers who may cough up, and trying to better understand and link that this the mucin in this phlegm is really linked potentially causally with this bronchitis, whereas mucin phlegm is normally helpful to clear secretions. With people with chronic bronchitis, they produce too much of this mucin. Now, before we rush off to the next diagnostic test that's important and the treatments that are really important, we should also mention that for the smokers, the single greatest thing they can do to reduce their risk of chronic bronchitis, to reduce this abnormal mucin amount, would be to quit smoking.
And this may be a motivational tool, having some sort of marker that can, you know, tell your patients that they're at higher risk for developing and going on for moving from not just chronic bronchitis, but to COPD, which is the third leading cause of death in the United States. So really serious morbidity.
Speaking of morbidity, if we could have a pill that could really help people who are obese to lose weight, better pills than we currently have, which are there but not great, it would be a good thing, right?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, this next research that was published in the journal ACS Nano, sounds like a scientific advanced journal, and I think it is about research that was done in mice that maybe one day can help us do that.
Yeah, so we're not talking about the, when I hear patches, what do you think about? What comes to
mind? Well, I think like nicotine patches or other ways that you can deliver medications to the skin.
And we're talking about skin patches to dissolve fat.
The bad fat, because there's bad fat and good fat, kind of, right?
Yeah, in humans, we have two types of fats. So we have white fats and we have brown fats. And essentially what this study looked at, again, this was in mice models, so it may not be ready for prime time right now, but essentially showed that mice treated with this medicated skin patch had a 20% reduction in fat, and they actually had significantly lower fasting blood glucose levels compared to untreated mice. So may have some implications for diabetes in the future.
Yeah, they were able to convert the more of the good fat, less of the bad fat, and that's what you would like to see. I do have my concerns. We've seen a lot of advances in the fields, particularly in the obesity field, that have not fully panned out. So I'd really want to see this in human trials. I'd really want to see the side effects and make sure that we're not creating something. In the meantime, really work on intensive behavioral therapy. We've got some great programs.
Absolutely.
Well, that concludes the research that matters. When we return, we're going to be talking with Associate Dean and Chair in UNC's Department of Allied Health Sciences, Dr. Stephen Hooper, as well as Dr. Eileen Berker and Dr. Philip Griffin, professors in the speech and hearing and clinical rehabilitation and mental health, about the importance of interdisciplinary care and the UNC's Department of Allied Health Services. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Bacalis. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Today on Conversations, Michael, we get to have some really fascinating conversations about some of the research and figures and leaders behind allied health here in North Carolina and shaping allied health around the country. And we're first going to be talking with University of North Carolina's Allied Health Services Chair, Dr. Stephen Hooper, about the importance and the work and movement behind interdisciplinary care.
Welcome, Dr. Hooper, to the show today.
It is great to be here. And before we even get started, I want to thank you and the station for promoting Allied Health, especially as we move into Allied Health Week. So thank you.
Actually, let me just ask that question. We typically want to know a little bit about you and your work, which I am going to ask about. But why do we call it Allied Health Week? Because Michael and I, who are practicing family docs, it's Allied Health year continuous. Why does it have to be just a week?
Well, I would agree. I think it should be Allied Health year 24/7. As you all may know, Allied Health professionals actually encapsulate about 60% of the healthcare workforce. And so we are out there. It transverses over 100 different disciplines, and all are there to put the quality and quality of life, and all are there to provide evidence-based evaluation, diagnosis, treatment, prevention, wellness for patients, and to work collaboratively with nurses and physicians and other healthcare providers in moving toward that goal.
And we'd love to hear more about your background in child neuropsychology and how that brought you to the field of allied health.
Well, as a child neuropsychologist, I find myself working with a lot of different patient populations, ranging from children in particular as a child-oriented person, children with neuropsychiatric disorders, learning disabilities, depression, psychosis, to chronic conditions such as even things like chronic kidney disease and neurologic conditions like stroke and traumatic brain injury. And so those patient populations I'm very familiar with. You can't work with those populations, whether they're in a clinic, a school, or an inpatient setting, without working in tandem with allied health professionals, occupational therapists, physical therapists, rehabilitation counselors. They're all in the same environment. And so my profession has led me down that pathway of working collaboratively with that part of the workforce. The other part of it for me personally is upon my arrival in North Carolina now about 30 years ago, I worked in an interdisciplinary setting my entire career. So I have worked side by side in interdisciplinary teams with allied health professionals looking at evidence-based evaluations, diagnosis, treatment of pediatric patients with a large variety of different conditions. And so the neuropsychology background actually has prepared me to move into that setting, and it also has allowed me to work alongside great allied health professionals.
So let's dive right into that particular area, the evidence base that surrounds kind of this interdisciplinary care model. When I think back to my training, we knew the value of interdisciplinary care, but we weren't interdisciplinary. What do we know about today that we maybe didn't know 10 and 20 and 30 years ago? What does the evidence tell us? Is it better for patients?
Yes, in short, it is better for patients if you are able to have more eyes on the problem that you're trying to solve with respect to potential patient. And I think when you start working with other agencies in the community, like schools and clinics, on providing consultation or technical assistance, working with the group is a whole lot better than everybody throwing their own two cents in. There's an efficiency issue, but there are also data now that suggest that it's also better care, which is the whole reason why we do interdisciplinary service. It's so, just better care.
So in your particular field, maybe you can give us an example, because I'm thinking about how difficult it is for the family doc and Michael and I when we have a child come in that has neurodevelopmental things that need to be addressed, how limited we sometimes feel in our ability to provide the range of services. Give us an example of perhaps a child that you might see and the setting you work in that demonstrates how this might really improve their care.
There's a lot of ways this can be played out, and it gets back to the terminology. You talk about interdisciplinary, well, there's other terms, multidisciplinary, and there's a transdisciplinary. The interdisciplinary workings truly are professionals stepping into each other's role, not to do the job, but to understand what is going on with a particular patient. So, as an example, we have worked with kids coming in with traumatic brain injury. And with those kids, you can do a neuropsychological assessment, get a good sense of the cognitive abilities, compare and contrast how they were doing before the injury, perhaps make some projections about prognosis and recovery. But you also need to know if there are motor dysfunctions. Where's the OT and the PT in that?
The occupational therapist and the physical therapist.
That's correct. And if there are speech and language issues or perhaps hearing issues secondary to the injury, you need to have that expertise in there too, as opposed to me either not paying attention to it because that's not what I do, or recognizing it and referring it out. For some families, they may get it, and other families, they may not get those services because of resources and location. So I think bringing everybody together to talk about the various needs of that child with traumatic brain injury, it allows us to plan more efficiently, find resources in that family's community, guide the family with expert guidance, not just from me, but from people who really know their particular areas. And I would think in your situation as family docs, having access to those kinds of resources so that you don't have to feel like you're doing it all is really important. And again, at the end of the day, it should provide better care for that patient and their family.
A quarterback can't really win a game without 11 other players on
right.
offense
and
defense.
Right, and if you have a very bad front line, your quarterback may not do so well. Yeah.
Dr. Hooper, so the Department of Allied Health Sciences is kind of closely affiliated with the School of Medicine. What is the Allied Health Sciences' role in educating, you know, members within the School of Medicine and other departments and surrounding really collaboration? Because it seems to be a crucial piece of what you do every day.
Well, thank you for asking that question, because it is sort of the hallmark of what we do in my department. And as you probably know, we are technically a school within a school. So we sit within the School of Medicine, but we function as a programmatic line of educational programs. Right now we have 7 or 8 of those programs, and our job in each of those programs is to train the next generation of providers, the next generation of leaders in their particular areas. So we have physical therapy. Let's see if I can remember them all. Physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech and hearing sciences, which includes audiology, and you're going to hear from Phil Griffin later in the show. We have rehabilitation counseling, and Eileen Berker's with us today. We have a couple of sciences. We have clinical laboratory science. We have sleep science. We also have radiologic science and our new physician assistance program. And I believe you talked to Paul Chalminski previously. Yes. about our new PA program.
Yes.
So that's our program, and we're looking to expand it. But in each of those programs, to your question, is we're really looking to train the next generation of students, and we're working real hard to bring those student populations together from that interdisciplinary perspective. But at the end of the day, our job is to train these folks. And as an aside, I will say my programs do exceptionally well with respect to not just North Carolina, but the country. We have darn near 100% graduation rates, darn near 100% employment rates, darn near 100% exam pass rates for certification in their areas. And I'm really happy to say about 2/3 of our graduates end up in North Carolina.
So let me ask a question. This is probably the last question we have in the remaining minute is, what's the biggest challenge facing the discipline of allied health today, and how are you going to go about helping solve it?
There's about 4 different sort of paths I could take with that, but in the interest of time, I think our biggest challenge is that there's not enough of us. So the projections suggest that allied health is going to grow at twice the rate of the economy in the next decade. We are struggling to get enough people out there to be allied health professionals. And so what we have been talking about as a faculty and as a program with the School of Medicine and with the University of North Carolina proper is how can we grow? How can we expand our programs? What are the best models to do that? It doesn't have to be brick and mortar at the School of Medicine. It could be hybrid programs where we use virtual training or online modules. So each of the program's leaders is looking at that to say, how can we grow so that we can address this need of sort of a lack of professionals in allied health sciences?
Well, we certainly want to thank you, Dr. Hooper, for your vision and passion and leadership. We've had a number of your faculty on the show talking about really cutting-edge issues affecting patients that Michael and I see, and I know we're going to look forward to talking with Dr. Eileen Berker and Dr. Philip Griffin in our next segment. Thank you so much for the work you're doing.
Thank you, and I really appreciate your facilitation of our presence in Allied Health Week. Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversations. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Michael Baca-Atlas. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health, and we're continuing our conversations about interdisciplinary care and research and specialized areas within allied health. And we're talking with Dr. Eileen Berker, Division Director and Professor of Clinical Rehabilitation and Mental Health Counseling, and Dr. Philip Griffin, Clinical Associate Professor of Speech and Hearing Sciences. Welcome to Your Health.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Welcome to the show. We really appreciate you guys being here today.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
We were just hearing from Dr. Hooper about the vision and the direction from where allied health has come and where it needs to go. You're really in the trenches. You're doing research. You're doing teaching and clinical care. Tell us each how you both got interested in the disciplines that you're doing. And maybe, Eileen, we'll start with you.
Well, I was a student in the PhD program in clinical psychology at Auburn University, and I enjoyed everything I did. I worked in student mental health, and I like that. And I worked at the VA, and I like that. And I worked in a community mental health center, and that was good. But when I went on internship at Duke, I was part of the heart transplant team there and fell in love with transplant. And so then when I came to UNC to take a position as a faculty member in rehab counseling, which is now, and clinical mental health counseling, I had the opportunity to work with the UNC heart and lung transplant team, and I've been there now for 25 years, and it's incredibly meaningful, and I really enjoy my work.
Well, and we're so glad you're doing that work, and we're going to have lots of questions for you, but first.
Let's see. I was first interested in speech pathology, actually. I was interested in speech production and accent reduction and things like that. But being a musician as well, I was exposed to my first audiology classes in my undergrad work in speech pathology and realized that I could use sound actually as a type of medicine in audiology. So sound as a way to treat people, sound as a way to improve people's lives. And that just resonated with me. No pun intended there.
Can you give us an example of that? What do you mean?
So, for example, one of the major things that audiologists do is we take people who have hearing loss, anywhere from mild to profound hearing loss, and who are essentially living in a quiet or a silent world, and we give them back the sounds that are out there in the world by using hearing aids or other assistive sound devices.
Nice. Yeah. Nice.
And Dr. Berker, you mentioned sort of your work related to mental health and transplants. This just really seems really fascinating. Talk to us a little bit about some of the things that you do related to that and sort of the work related to quality of life surrounding transplants and maybe how that's changed since transplants maybe 20 years ago and today.
Well, those are big questions. Well, transplant, when it works, is a miracle. It is just an amazing thing to see someone who can't walk or has a ventricular assist device or is carrying oxygen around, and then they get their transplant and they're going to the mall or they're going deep sea fishing, and it's just the coolest thing you could ever see, but it's a journey fraught with uncertainty and stress. And so people get depressed or they get anxious or they have trouble sleeping. And sometimes they can't really share that with their family because their families are their caregivers and they don't want to burden them. So the lovely role I get to play is to be there to ask about the anxiety and ask about the depression, and then to be there either if they're local to provide treatment or to find resources for them in their hometowns, to get them to the point where they can get their transplant, you know, when it finally arrives, whenever that is, that they're strong enough psychologically to be able to take advantage of it and get through it. And sometimes I don't see people before transplant. I see people after transplant. So they sort of soldier through the waiting period and the uncertainty, and then their transplant comes. But then afterwards, they might get anxious, or they feel like they've forgotten how to breathe, or they're afraid to go out and exercise with their new heart. And so sometimes I see folks after.
You know, I'm thinking about, as I came through training, I didn't really think as a family doctor I was going to be necessarily taking care of transplant patients. That was going to be someone else. But as time went on, I've recognized that I'm increasingly taking care of a large number of transplant patients because of how many people are getting transplants, but also because the how many people need this interdisciplinary coordinated care. I wonder, what differentiates the type of kind of work that you do with transplant patients from, let's say, a psychologist who may see just, oh, I'm only here to treat their anxiety and depression? How does the work that you do kind of amplify, differentiate, add to that sort of work?
Well, I am a clinical psychologist and also a rehab counselor by training. I am both. And so as a psychologist on the team, I sit in on the team meetings. So the heart team and the lung transplant team meet every week, and everyone is around the table. So it's me, the social worker, the pulmonologist, cardiologist, surgeons, financial coordinator, social worker, and nurse coordinators. And so we're all there at the table, and we talk about each patient each week so that we're taking care of the whole person. And, you know, nice. I may not know if someone's anxious, but the PT might know that they're anxious, because when they go to pulmonary rehab or cardiac rehab, maybe they're not doing as well as they could, or maybe they're having a panic attack while they're on the treadmill. So we're together, and frequently they'll just email me or give me a call, but we're all together every week where we can talk about
nice.
Everything.
And that seems like truly a collaborative effort, which is sort of what we've been talking about related to allied health kind of as a whole. And Dr. Griffin, can you kind of give us an example, too, of how interdisciplinary work really plays out in your clinical work and in your day?
I would say there are a couple different ways that an audiologist can work interdisciplinarily. I see adults primarily, but pediatric audiology is one area where an interdisciplinary approach is just critical between audiologists, pediatric ear, nose, and throat physicians, child psychologists, child neuropsychologists, PT, all sorts of professionals coming together for children who may have complex issues that need management from multiple directions, and hearing loss being one of those main things that will, if can be corrected or aided, allow the child to access their education. So when you start talking about children, I think that's one of the main areas where interdisciplinary work is just critical. I can also see it as very critical in terms of vertigo and balance assessment as well. When you start talking about balance, dizziness, risk of falling, there are so many body systems that can play into those problems, including the inner ear, which is what the audiologists are focused on. But of course, PTs, OTs, ear, nose, and throat physicians, primary care doctors, and pharmacists are highly involved in those patients. And the more interdisciplinary care you have with those patients, the better the outcomes as well.
So I want to ask you a question that is kind of really burning inside of me, and that has to do with the lack of reimbursement for hearing aids.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's got to be something that drives you maybe crazy every day. Mm-hmm. Help us understand how you think maybe the solution maybe could or may not involve interdisciplinary collaboration among researchers to push this into the public policy agenda of the American people.
That's very interesting. It's complex. And in JAMA, there was a recent article that came out where there was essentially people saying, you know, it's time for Medicare to reimburse for vision, I believe, dental, and hearing. So that was kind of an op-ed piece that came out or an editorial piece that came out. So I think there is this building swell of this idea that we need to get people to the point where they can eat, where they can see, and where they can hear. And I think you'll see that start to increase and that momentum grow as time goes on. Right now, it is very difficult. It is a situation where you have a lot of people who need hearing treatment specifically and can't really afford to do it. There's about 38 million people in America with hearing loss, and about one-fifth of them are aided or having some assistance. So that's quite a low percentage when you think of all the people that really could be helped and how it could, that change in their lives could ripple out into society. As far as the interdisciplinary question, I'm not sure. That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know how an interdisciplinary approach could help in terms of the care. I know that an interdisciplinary voice.
Yes.
Could really help this.
Yeah, I think we could all be down in Washington and our yes. state legislatures demanding change. Count me in.
Absolutely.
So we have time for one final question. What final thoughts would you like to leave our listeners with today about the importance of interdisciplinary work?
Well, I think interdisciplinary care treats the whole person, and so you're going to get the best outcome and, you know, going to make the patient happier and improve their quality of life.
I would agree wholeheartedly and specifically to audiology. As audiology attempts to make more practitioners and more young audiologists and put them out there for this demographic wave that we have coming of elderly folks, I think that integrating with PT, OT, primary care, and all the disciplines could help more people get the care that they need for these very important issues.
I'd say it's from your mouth to God's ears. Thank you all both so much for being our guests today, Dr. Philip Griffin, Dr. Eileen Berker, and Dr. Hooper, who was here for the first segment of Conversations. Thank you for what you do for your health.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Michael Bacchialis. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, I get to have our special guest, Dr. Bob Gwyther, who's joining me to answer questions about our listeners' health. Thanks for joining us for your House Calls, Bob.
You're welcome.
You know, if our listener has a question they'd like us to address on an upcoming show, they can send comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first House Call question about an unfortunate situation with a young adult woman.
I'm a 24-year-old woman. Breast cancer runs in my family, and I'm wondering when I should start being more alert for signs of problems.
Well, first off, we're sorry to hear that it runs in your family. That is not something you would be alone at, because breast cancer, I think, you know, one out of eight women may get diagnosed with breast cancer at some point in time in their life, certainly having abnormal mammograms, and so a lifetime risk. The great majority of these women will not die from their breast cancer. And so running in your family is something that perhaps means that you're having earlier breast cancer. It may be one of the risk factors for genetic syndromes of breast cancer, like maybe having genes for what's called the BRCA gene that may put you at really high risk of breast cancer.
And I think it's a good idea to get this discussed with your primary care provider, whoever that is, because she might want to do things her way, and she's going to clearly incorporate your desires in this too. Big question is, how old are these women in your family when they get this, and have any of them had genetic testing to show that they're at high risk?
Well, one might say is many women are at, you know, moderate risk because of the how frequent breast cancer can be and picking up on mammograms. And those women would typically go through the typical, what we would call an informed decision making with their provider, talking about the risk or benefits of getting mammography and whether they would start doing that at age 50. Some would say age 40, more people maybe 50. But that discussion would happen in the context of that. If you're at high risk, so perhaps you had radiation to your chest area that may make your breast more likely to have that breast cancer. If you've had a personal history of breast cancer or ovarian cancer, if you have, you know, two or three women in your family who've had breast cancer, if that gene tests positive, that BRCA gene, well, you're at high risk. You have a lifetime risk certainly greater than 20%. Those people really need to go see perhaps a specialist and talk about what are their options.
Your primary care provider is a good place to start.
It's a good place to start because those questions are going to be, at what age do you start having mammogram? What age do you perhaps even consider something more aggressive? Would you consider surgery or not? Do you get genetic testing if you haven't, which increasingly many people would? Thanks so much for the question and our best to you. Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've been a smoker since I was a teenager. Recently, I quit smoking, but I still use chewing tobacco. Do you have any recommendations for quitting tobacco products altogether?
Well, first off, kudos for quitting what we would call combustible cigarettes. On the continuum of risk, where combustible cigarettes is one end of that risk, you certainly have perhaps lowered your overall risk. We know your risk, though, is still there, and you want to quit being dependent on tobacco products or nicotine entirely. Some people would do a nicotine replacement products, but the problem with that is you might still be dependent on the nicotine, but you wouldn't be getting any of the cancer-causing substances. That'd be a good thing.
It would be. And I don't know if Chantix really helps with this.
I think it's a good idea. So this medicine called varenicline, otherwise known as Chantix, which kind of makes people not want to smoke at all or use anything. And if they do, they're like, didn't really help me at all. That actually can be probably the single greatest effect. It may have slightly more side effects, but gives you a 30% chance. And don't underestimate seeing a tobacco treatment specialist. Get some support because you need strategies for what to do because you're going to be around cues. You may be stressed when you eat, when you're hungry, lots of different things that may stimulate you to want to use the product. And you got to deal with those psychological cues in addition to the physical cues.
And a lot of times it depends on what everybody's doing around you. If everybody around you is smoking and drinking beer or whatever, it's tougher to do. So don't go to that scene if you know that in advance.
You know, lots of things. I think this is one of those things because quitting chew, smokeless tobacco actually can be even more addictive than regular cigarettes. So this could be really helpful. We run a great program at the University of North Carolina, Nicotine Dependence Program. Wes, our great health science librarians, to also put information specifically about helping people who want to quit smokeless or chewing tobacco. Thank you for your question. Laura, what's our very last house call?
My mother's doctor recently told us that my mother has dementia but not Alzheimer's. I was hoping you could give us a little clarity about that. What's the difference? Does the nuance of that diagnosis change the way we should consider her treatment and care?
Absolutely. Wonderful question.
Yeah, there are actually about 50 kinds of dementia, so there's a lot more than Alzheimer's. But truth is that Alzheimer's is 60 to 80% of the dementia, so it's the lion's share. Other common ones are atherosclerotic dementias. They tend to progress when you have little strokes. And
there's a Parkinson's dementia.
A Parkinson's
which
dementia.
We see sometimes that kind of somewhere in between those two. You know, Bob, my mom, who passed away earlier this year, had vascular dementia. And we noticed it a number of years ago. And I guess for us, the fact that it wasn't Alzheimer's was useful because we knew that it might progress, but it actually progressed much more slowly. Alzheimer's can sometimes progress much more rapidly. Ultimately, it could lead you to the same place. I think a diagnosis is helpful. I would really encourage you to find out what kind of dementia it is so that you can be better prepared perhaps to know what you can do. There was a great book. Laura, who was that guest that we had? It was The Five Languages of Love with People with Alzheimer's and Dementia.
Gary Chapman.
It was a wonderful, great book. We certainly want to recommend that book again in response to this question. It really helps family members.
And addressing your risk factors, which include the same things as for coronary artery disease or any other vascular dementia is good. I mean, if you can get your cholesterol down, quit smoking, doing the things that keep your blood pressure in good control, that will help too.
Yeah, great question. And our thoughts are with you, and we hope that the resources will be useful. Thank you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues and concerns important to you and your health. You can send any issue you want us to address at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can visit us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, My great guest, co-host Dr. Michael Baca Atlas, and our guests today, Dr. Stephen Hooper, Dr. Eileen Berker, and Dr. Philip Griffin. We hope you join us next time on Your Health. On behalf of Your Health, we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.